Everyone, I would like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. It's Tuesday, February 12th.
I know you do.
And colleagues, we don't have the fiscal on Senate Bill 109, so we'll move that to the bottom of the agenda, and hopefully we'll have the fiscal by then. But I would like to now open a work session on Senate Bill 106. Sandy, can you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 106 allows the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners and the State Board of Pharmacy to establish certain fees by rule. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And we have all the paperwork to take action on the bill if the committee so chooses.
Yes.
We are in work session, right?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 106 to the Senate floor without recommendation and request the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 106 to the floor without recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there discussion? I did talk to the chair of the Ways and Means, and of course he would like to have all boards not raise their fees until after Ways and Means. But this bill is asking to do it before, which a number of the other boards already do. So we're just going to send it without recommendation to them. Okay, no discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Tanger Newer?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Ponson?
Aye. Motion passes. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122. Sandy, could you bring us up to date on this particular bill? And while we're getting, I got to do this.
You can do that. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 122, it was sponsored by Senator Shields. It authorizes the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules prohibiting or limiting coverage by health benefit plans of items, services, or medical technologies pursuant to the guidance by the Health Evidence Review Commission.
All right.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. I'm here to tee off and bring before you Senate Bill 122 that was brought to me by Dr. Jack McAnulty and Larry Kirsch and Amy Johnson. Dr. McAnulty is a well-regarded cardiologist and a former professor at Oregon Health Sciences University. His claim to fame is having taught a certain Senator Steiner Hayward, I hear, when she was just coming up through the ranks. But I think really what this bill gets to is to begin the conversation about how we can best use the evidence to inform the health insurance rate review process and begin to use that process to bring down the cost of health care. And that being said, Madam Chair, I will hand it off to Mr. Kirsch and to Ms. Amy Johnson, an attorney well experienced in health care regulatory issues in Texas.
All yours.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Larry Kirsch. I'm an economist in Portland, Oregon. With me is Amy Johnson, a consumer attorney in Portland as well. Dr. McAnulty, I had a call from him just a moment ago. He was somehow or other en route. So I don't know whether he will be able to make it or not, but he's going to give it his best. Let me just start out by saying that the New York Times, if you had an opportunity to take a look this morning, had some enormously good news on the front page. It indicated that healthcare costs were trending downward, and the speculation was that a number of systematic innovations like SB 122 are beginning to kick in a big way. I think that this really is something that many of us have been waiting for a very long time. The purpose of SB 122, which is a evidence-based medical benefits bill, is to try to speed up the adoption of evidence-based medicine standards, which have been developed over a number of years by the medical profession, by members of the insurance industry community, and by other medical educators, to develop rigorous testing, objective testing of what works and what doesn't work in medicine, to establish really gold standards of care, which are based on randomized clinical trials and other methodologies, and to increase the consistency with which medicine is practiced. Many people really don't understand that, depending on where you live in the state or where you live in the country, medicine will be practiced in one way, another way, it'll be practiced in a different way. And also to take into account cost-effectiveness, to look at cost-effectiveness issues. Guidelines have been implemented. These are not new. Medical guidelines have been implemented in practice. They've been implemented through professional education channels. They've been implemented through professional networks, physician networks. They've been implemented through third-party reimbursement, through Medicaid, through Medicare, through private insurance, and also through consumer channels. If you read Consumer Reports, for example, you will see in issue after issue evidence about what kinds of drugs work, what kinds of drugs are less effective. And those standards, frankly, were really developed here at OHSU by somebody that you all know very well, which is the governor, under his stewardship as the head of the of a center at OHSU. The problem that's addressed by the bill really is speed of adoption of these standards and the completeness of the application of these standards. There's reference to the fact that roughly 50% of physicians where there is a medical guideline have in fact adopted the guideline, even after the guideline has been out, has been validated, has been in medical publications, etc. And there is a tremendous variability, as I mentioned before, throughout a state in who is using it, how many people are using it in practice. So this bill tries to get at those two issues. It really tries to get at trying to get the bill, the medical evidence standard, used more frequently and to get it used more consistently. The innovative approach of the bill is it takes the next, it's a really a small step in the direction that we've been talking about. It's really a pilot bill. It's a bill to have to set up what would be effectively a pilot program to try this approach out. Not to do it on one fell swoop, but to try to do it gradually, step by step. It uses the existing insurance division authority to require insurers and health plans to adopt standard covered benefits and do that for a small number of evidence-based procedures or drugs or practices. And those standards would be developed by the health authorities, Health Evidence Review Commission, or the HERC, again set up by law, and with a mission to try to take evidence-based standards and not only disseminate them to Medicaid, but also into private insurance practice. This would be a step directly in that direction. There would also be a provision, and we've provided some language, which I believe the LC is working on right now, to incorporate an amendment to the original bill as proposed, and that was to set up an individual waiver mechanism so that if an individual patient would not be well served by the standard benefit but would be served by an alternative, to provide that opportunity, or if there were issues related to, for example, Christian Science and other kinds of practices that felt that they were not being recognized or could not be recognized well in evidence-based medicine, to provide an opportunity for them to get a waiver, that opportunity would be provided by regulation. That regulation would be through rule developed by the insurance division. The waivers themselves would be managed through the independent review organizations so that they would not be managed by individual health insurance companies, but would by independent, impartial, professional organization that would determine whether the waiver should or should not be granted. The cost savings, there have been in the literature, again, and in practice, there have been some very, very significant cost savings, and I provided in the fact sheet that was distributed to members of the committee one example of an evidence-based medical standard having to do with clearing blockages in the coronary artery, where there are multiple ways of going about it, and some are applicable and useful in some kinds of patients, and some have been demonstrated not to be useful in those same patients. The cost savings from those are, again, in the table that you've got there, have varied and are demonstrated from year by year, from the first year all the way through to a lifetime cost, and are demonstrably very, very substantial. I believe that the division is, I don't know what they finished, but they were working on a fiscal, so I believe that that information will come to you. I don't have that information. I haven't seen it myself.
I talked with the department, and there will be a fiscal, but we don't have it now.
So those are I believe is what I really wanted to bring to you, that it is an innovation. Oregon would be the first state that would in fact take this approach. The approach has been used in other forms of insurance, mainly in homeowners. It's been used in a limited basis in healthcare, but not. It would really be a. It would be something that would. I think Oregon would really be justly credited with taking, and look forward to answering any questions that members of the committee might have.
Questions?
Good afternoon, Senators. My name's Amy Johnson, and it was alluded to, I had insurance experience in Texas, and so I'll just start with that. I hope you don't hold that against me. The state of Texas has a state agency that represents insurance consumers, and the state agency is headed by an appointee of the governor who's confirmed by the Senate, and that person is called the public counsel, and that office is funded through money that comes through insurance. We had about $1 million budget a year, and so I was the public counsel appointed by Governor Ann Richards, and I served in that position. I was the first public counsel because it was set up under Governor Richards, and I participated in drafting rules. Our agency had the authority to sue the insurance department. We represented insurance consumers. I represented businesses and workers' compensation issues, whoever was buying insurance, and we all are insurance consumers, so basically, I got to represent everybody, and lots of rate hearings and rule issues and things like that. So that's the experience that I bring. And I am now a Portland, Oregon attorney, so I'm new to here, but been here for a little while. And I'm here because I believe that Oregon is a leader in evidence-based medicine. The OHSU, Dartmouth, they're two of the big leaders in evidence-based medicine. Oregon is taking a lead in HERC by establishing a government entity that reviews certain kinds of procedures and drugs to set the standard for what should be the practice of medicine. And what I think that Senate Bill 122 allows is insurance policies to work, the insurance division to work with HERC and members of the affected community in drawing up these kinds of rules, and bit by bit to codify in the insurance policy, this is what you're going to do most of the time, and this is what we're going to pay for. Because the thing about insurance is what you want is it to be effective and affordable, because if somebody is getting care that is not supported by the evidence, then the rest of us are paying for it, because that's the way insurance works, is we all pay for the use of insurance. And so the reason that this is good for consumers is, first, it focuses on effective care, which has been established by HERC and should be agreed to by the medical community. And one of the things that HERC is supposed to look at is affordability. And so that what they're hopefully focusing on is the most effective, the most efficient care that's also affordable and will save in the long run for insurance consumers. The other thing that Mr. Kirsch just suggested is that the bill has a waiver provision. And the suggestion it would be done under this independent review process that's like insurance companies are used to when there's somebody who falls outside of the normal standard, that you go to an independent review. And the proposal is that would be paid for through the insurance policies. That's not going to be a cost to the state, that it would be just, an independent medical kind of review. The process that's envisioned is a rulemaking process, which is inclusive. So the whole idea is that the legislature gives the authority to the insurance division to begin to work with HERC on what are the top three good guidelines that we can put in our insurance policies. Let's see if it works and develop a rule to do that and work with the medical community and the people in healthcare to gain support for those and put them into the policy. I think that this legislation will lead to lower costs in the long run and to more effective and efficient care, and I think it's a win for consumers. Thank you.
Great. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both, Ms. Johnson and Mr. Kirsch, for coming, and Senator Shields. Those who are looking at the bill will see that I'm a co-sponsor of this bill, and I did it for exactly the reason that Senator Shields pointed out. We need to have a much more in-depth conversation about the use of evidence-based practices, or as Ms. Johnson pointed out, we are ahead of the curve in many ways, but in other ways, we have a huge challenge. In my other life, I'm a medical educator, and I spend a lot of time thinking about how do we disseminate evidence-based guidelines. And I'll give you an example of one of the things that Mr. Kirsch pointed out. People who have certain heart conditions or artificial heart valves take warfarin, which is a blood thinner, to prevent blood clots. About 5 years ago, Dr. McAnulty could give you the exact number, the recommendations from the American Heart Association about the levels of that drug changed to a lower level, which would reduce the risk of excess bleeding caused by the drug. And yet, I would venture to say that a full 50% of patients who are taking the medication are still using the old guidelines. And there are plenty of cardiologists and primary care physicians who are managing these patients who don't even know that the guidelines have changed, or who think for one reason or another that no matter what the guidelines say, they should do it the old way. So we've got a problem. And whether doing it through insurance coverage is the best way to do it, I'm not sure I know, but I do think that having this conversation is really, really important, and I'm very glad, Mr. Kirsch, that you brought this to our attention, and of course I have the utmost respect for the work that you've done, and Dr. McAnulty is a dear friend and a very well-respected teacher of mine. So I'm very glad you brought this up. This is a huge problem, but it's not just the insurance company's problem. It's the physician's problem. It's the nurse practitioner's problem. It's the PAs. It's the dentists. It's pretty much anybody who provides any kind of health care. And so we need to be thinking about this on as broad a level as possible. Doesn't mean we shouldn't pursue possible solutions, taking one piece at a time, but we need to have a much, much more in-depth conversation about using evidence-based practices to offer the best, the highest quality, most cost-effective care to our patients in this state.
Other comments?
Thank you very, very much for coming.
Thanks. John C. Powell. Let's go with one more positive.
Janine Rodriguez.
Janine Rodriguez.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay.
Just get your thunder stolen, Mr. Powell.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janine Meyer Rodriguez, and I represent SEIU, Service Employees International Union, Local 503. We represent approximately 50,000 workers who work in state and local governments, as well as included in that number, 20,000 care providers who take care of seniors, people with disabilities, and children in state-funded child care. We would like to go on the record in support of SB 122 for at least three reasons. One, we, like everybody else, are trying to get the best deal on health care for our members. And, you know, we're up against many obstacles in the way of that. I think everybody is aware of that. Number two, we believe that healthcare evidence is a good thing, and we support its expansion. And third, and perhaps most important to us, we want to educate and activate our members on how we can also be part of the solution in helping to improve the quality of healthcare while at the same time containing costs. So I would like to take this opportunity to say a few words about the conversation that Senator Steiner Hayward was referring to, because I think that you really hit it on the head in that there's a lot we need to do on this issue, and that really does, I think, include the patients. So, you know, the conversation needs to be as broad as possible, not only among providers, but the patients. I think that for us, patient activation and empowerment is a key part of solving our healthcare crisis as we go forward. And we also believe that getting people to understand the science, also other things related to the evidence-based guidelines, are really key to making them work. So SEIU is actually part of a campaign called Choosing Wisely. At the international level, we joined that campaign, and it's basically an effort to provide resources for consumers and doctors around the country to engage in these conversations about the overuse or misuse of medical tests, procedures, and other services that provide little benefit and, in some cases, real harm. And I think what we've noticed about this campaign is it's all great, but it's also at a much higher level, information directed at physicians. And so we're really trying to push for trying to get information that consumers can understand and actually believe in, because the key to actually making good choices is having some trust, you know, in that information. And I think when people are facing healthcare choices, and especially when they're really ill, there's a lot of emotion around it. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of questions around what your doctor may be saying or what you saw on television, which is probably something you ought to ignore. When there's ads about healthcare or drugs, these things tend to get people to bring up, you know, whether they should get certain services or certain drugs that they may not need. So this is obviously an obstacle that gets in the way. So we believe that the solution really is better education, that people can understand, engagement around these decisions and conversations with their doctors, and working with organizations that they can trust. So for us, we're clearly trying to work on, at the state level, we have members in PEB. And I think, you know, we think PEB does a pretty good job of trying to get at cutting-edge issues that can address cost and quality. And now we feel like we can add to the solution in educating our own members about all of these things. So we urge your support for this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Now, John C. Powell and Dan Jarman, might as well have both of you come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is John C. Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Respectfully, we are opposed to Senate Bill 122 as written. but am encouraged by what Senator Shields and Senator Steiner Hayward had to say about starting the conversation about evidence-based guidelines and practices, and that's a conversation my client does want to have and does support. Senate Bill 122, as written, we believe is not the gold standard for evidence-based treatment and does not include adequate input from specialty fields, which leads us to the concern that it will possibly restrict treatment options not only for our members but for other members who have private health insurance in Oregon. I want to give an example of how Regents and a lot of health plans do and implement evidence-based guidelines and policies in their companies. At Regents, we employ experienced staff with advanced degrees in clinical research and interpretation of scientific literature who have the expertise to perform critical analysis of the very latest scientific literature. In addition, Regents medical directors meet every month with medical policy teams to address new medical policies as well as update existing ones. And again, each month they seek input from a panel of expert clinicians within the local community and consult specialty physicians every time a new medical policy is implemented or changed. Finally, they consider clinical experts from the most highly respected academic medical centers across the country. In summary, Regents' mission is to get the right care for their members in the right setting, and we are concerned the bill as written will restrict treatment options for our members, and that is why we are opposed to the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Great. Let's go ahead with Dan.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing Providence Health and Services. This is the first time I'll be testifying in front of the committee this session. I feel badly that I'm speaking against a bill that's sponsored by two of the members of the committee. Please don't hold that against me. Hopefully we'll chat about many nice things this session. I wanted to just speak very briefly to you to submit for the record a letter from Dr. Bob Gluckman, who is the Chief Medical Officer for Providence Health Plans. That letter should be in front of you outlining Providence's concerns. Providence Health Plan manages medical and pharmaceutical benefits for about 375,000 Oregonians in the state of Oregon. We strongly support evidence-based medicine, and we just do it differently than what is emphasized in this bill. Providence uses a successful Medi-Cal management program. We think this bill is more of a one-size-fits-all. What we really need is a balance between population-based care with meeting the needs of individuals who may have complex medical conditions. So we join others who've said we're very willing to have conversations about evidence-based practices. We've actually started some conversations with Senator Steiner Hayward on this, and we would like to continue that conversation into the future. So please, please know we're welcome to continue this, but we just have concerns with this bill, and you can refer to Dr. Gluckman's comments for more information. Thank you.
Thank you. Comment. All right. Thank you very much, panel. Jim Gardner, Nan Heim, and Dennis McNanny.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade association that represents the majority of the research-based drug companies operating in the United States. Regretfully, I must tell you that we do oppose this bill. Like the prior witnesses, we welcome the opportunity to have a dialogue, which we have participated in on an ongoing basis for a number of years now with both HERC, the P&T committee, and the predecessor of that, the Health Resources Commission, on a variety of issues that are of concern to the industry and we think are relevant to the public health of the state of Oregonians. This bill, we would respectfully suggest, is not the right way to begin that dialogue. It is fundamentally at odds with the market-based system of health insurance that's contemplated by PPACA, and specifically the health insurance exchanges that are established under PPACA. The success of that system heavily depends upon the ability of insurers to compete in terms of benefit design so that the consumer will have an option or a series of options under the exchange. I wanted to specifically also draw your attention to the next to the last two paragraphs of my written testimony, because this is one of the unintended consequences, I think, of the bill. The bill authorizes the DCBS director to adopt rules making the HERC treatment guidelines mandatorily applicable to enrollees in plans through Cover Oregon. This is expressly prohibited by the terms of the federal PPACA's anti-discrimination provisions. Under federal law, plans in the individual and small group markets must provide essential health benefits, EHB. EHB cannot be based on a benefit design or implementation of a benefit design that discriminates on the basis of an individual's age, expected length of life, an individual's present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life or other health concerns. And some of you may not be aware of this, but many elements of the current HERC treatment guidelines and the prioritized list, for that matter, expressly limit care based on life expectancy. And the basic premise of the list is that providing care for patients with certain diseases is a low priority. This is not consistent with PPACA, which provides that EHB benefits cannot be denied, and I'm going to quote from the federal law now, to individuals against their wishes on the basis of the individual's age or expected length of life, or of the individual's present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life. This bill would create a situation by incorporating the HERC guidelines that would be fundamentally inconsistent with the federal PPACA.
Comments? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Advanced Medical Technology Association, known as AdvaMed. And like Mr. German, I'm not totally thrilled with my appearance being in opposition to a bill sponsored by two members of the committee. AdvaMed is a national trade association whose members are companies that produce medical technologies and medical devices. We do have some members in Oregon, Biotronic in Clackamas County, that produces pacemakers, and there's one in Bend, Clear Catheter Systems, and I just looked at their website, and they've just announced, like 10 days ago, a new technology to help patients recover faster from heart surgery. As you know, the Health Evidence Commission reviews and medical technologies and then issues coverage guidances that may limit or deny coverage for some technologies and treatments. And these are primarily now, I believe, for coordinated care organizations. Our members are fine. In fact, they're supportive of evidence-based medical research when it's used to help physicians, nurse practitioners, other healthcare practitioners determine what might be best for their patients. But we're not fine when these guidances become across-the-board mandates that this is how treatment has to be provided. One thing I've learned, I've been to, I think, 4 or 5 meetings of subcommittees and of the commission and watched them. And one thing I've learned is that it isn't always as simple as this works and this doesn't work. I watched consideration that went on for several meetings of a proposed coverage guidance on something called FAI syndrome, and unfortunately I can't pronounce what the acronym stands for, but it is something that's very painful and that can be and has been treated with hip surgery. And the commission was ready to approve a coverage guidance that said no coverage. We had an orthopedist come and talk to them. She works at OHSU. She's done several of these surgeries. And what she said to them was, I agree with you that this is not necessarily the best treatment for most patients, But for a percentage of patients who, yes, are elderly, this is the only treatment that is available now to relieve the significant pain that they have besides pain medications. I think an important point about the Health Evidence Review Commission is that what it's doing is really pretty new. Dennis is going to talk about he and I just served on an advisory committee to help them develop administrative rules, their first administrative rules, and they've just gone into effect. As I said, I've attended several meetings of the commission. I've talked with people who are in the audience, their physicians and other healthcare practitioners, practice managers, patients, and they're all just figuring out what this is and what the potential impact is. And frankly, some of them are very nervous about it and overwhelmed by how do I get involved? How can I help? How do we get the expertise involved in the process? And I just want to mention that I think this whole thing is one of many, many changes that you all have made, this legislature, in healthcare in recent years. And it needs to develop. There does need to be a conversation about it before its impact is expanded as much as this bill would propose. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Dennis.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Nan stated, we were both involved with developing a set of rules. This was my first trip through the muddy waters of rulemaking. I came out of it feeling pretty good, actually. I think everyone in the room...
Oh, you need to state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dennis McNanny with the Oregon Bioscience Association. My member companies include both members of AvaMed, which would be device companies, as well as pharmaceutical companies, but those only based in Oregon. So throughout that process, I came away feeling fairly good about the objectives of HERC. I think there was reasonable discussion and some disagreement as to what the final rules should be, but we all came around the table and agreed that a set of rules needed to be developed, and I value the opportunity we had in participating in that process. But all through that process, it was presumed, in fact, actively discussed, that because these were recommendations and guidelines, that it would give the flexibility to people providing care necessary to make some of those judgment calls. It's scary now retrospectively to look at those discussions and realize that many of the rules might have been considered differently if it had been envisioned that these would be required mandates set out to the insurers. I would also point out that my industry is driven by innovation, much of which comes out of OHSU. We've been fortunate in Oregon to have someone like Phil Knight willing to invest $225 million in these new innovative concepts, many of which would, I think, be suspect initially in discussions like this within the HERC, but eventually are going to lead to the economic stability that we all seek in Oregon. So I want to make Oregon a place where this sort of innovation can thrive. I do agree with my colleague, Nan, that I think the HERC rules as adopted, which will now be implemented as of January 17th, need to give time to function. We need to see how the private insurers react when given the guidances that are going to come out of this, and we need to see what changes maybe need to happen downstream, but we need to do that with some base of experience in actually using these coverage guidances before anyone's given the authority to make them mandatory. So again, I appreciate the time given to discuss. Open to any questions.
Thank you very much, panel. Is someone from the Agency of Department of Consumer and Business Affairs here at all? Just come up. You don't have to testify on the bill, Lou, but I want...
Boy, now we can get into the questions. So.
Lou, what I would like to do, because I do support the concept, but again, I think we need to figure out how this thing's going to work. I know that there would be a fiscal. I know we're in the middle of a Cover Oregon and all of what that entails. But I would like to appoint a work group just for the conversation to see if we can have the stakeholders here, and then maybe led by Chip and
and Senator Steiner Hayward to come up with how do we see this working in Oregon.
Madam Chair, we're happy to help you with that.
All right. So, Committee Chair, Administrator.
Who are you?
Would you?
Lou Savage, Insurance Commissioner for
Oregon.
Thank you. Oh, sorry about that. Yes, thank you, Senator Cruz. Steiner Hayward and Chip Shields, in order to see, because the concept is definitely good, but there's obviously a whole lot of work, I think, that needs to be done on this. Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to dive into the topic, and I appreciate the opportunity. It might be great to have some bipartisan participation in this work group.
I'd like to nominate Senator Cruz.
That makes a quorum.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that the group that you assigned, and at some point in time we can switch partners on it.
What I've done is
this is what happens when you get phone calls from reporters.
There's a lot, you missed a lot of the negative testimony.
But I've heard it before.
Yes, and like I said, I've supported the concept. We need to know how this is going to work, and I would like to have a work group with the stakeholders and the proponents of the bill, along with the department, to see how we can maybe come together on how maybe this could work in Oregon.
And Madam Chair, I think probably someone from the governor's office would like to be involved as well.
All right.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would suggest, you know, just so we don't have to cross too many bridges, that if Elizabeth would step aside, I'll step in.
Great. I'd be actually very grateful for that, Senator Cruz.
Great. Let's do that then. And so could you help coordinate that? Okay, thank you very much. Just one more thing on your plate. Sorry about that. All right. Those who are interested in being on this work group, I would like you to contact Sandy, the committee administrator, and that's who will be on the work group. Okay. All right, with that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 122 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 169.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 169 requires the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, Oregon Educator Benefit Board, Public Employees Benefit Board to identify activities that address diabetes care, and complications. Requires a report to the 2015-16 Legislative Assembly on the data, the programs, the outcomes, and proposed next steps.
Great. Nikki Terzieff, Tom Boyer, and Stuart Perry.
I'm doing this sort of thing.
Invite Paul Manning from the YMCA. From the American Diabetes Association.
See, I knew I wouldn't get your scribble on here.
Okay, Tom Boyer must be panel two.
Okay, so Nikki, Paul Manning, and Andrea Bruno will be the first panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nikki Terzieff here. For the record, I am here on behalf of Novo Nordisk, a couple of gentlemen you'll hear from in panel two, but also as a member of the Oregon Diabetes Coalition. We have been working on a bill similar to 169 for quite some time now, and it's a pleasure to be back before you all. Thanks for having us here again. Senate Bill 169 is pretty straightforward. It's going to have a cross-agency conversation. You're going to look at the plight of diabetes and the tide that's rushing into Oregon has been for quite some time, and unfortunately the needle has not moved very much. So we're here again. We're going to try and have this conversation. We've got a couple of letters that have been submitted to you all for the record via email in support of this effort, and a couple of folks here today that I'd like to turn over to.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for having us today. My name is Andrea Bruno. I'm the Executive Director of the American Diabetes Association of Oregon. And I'd like to share our support for SB 169 and any bills that require state agencies involved with diabetes to review and prioritize their efforts and develop action plans to reduce the burden of diabetes. And why should you be concerned about this? Well, we're recommending it because diabetes now affects more than 800,000 people here in Oregon. 8.2% of the adult population has diabetes, which is about 241,000 people. Over one-fourth of Oregon's kids are obese or at high risk for being obese, and for the first time ever, children are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Over 65,000 people have undiagnosed diabetes, and over 500,000 people have pre-diabetes. The cost to Oregon from diabetes direct and indirect costs is estimated at $1.4 billion each year. So we feel if we don't do something about the growing epidemic, the economic cost to Oregon will be crippling. Because of this, the American Diabetes Association strives to improve public policy as it relates to diabetes. This impending epidemic signals a need to implement coordinated efforts utilizing existing services, as well as those that need to be developed to effectively meet the public health challenge. The American Diabetes Association believes this legislation to create a diabetes action plan for Oregon will provide a more balanced and comprehensive approach to address the costs of diabetes and influence positive public policy to reduce the social and economic burden of diabetes in Oregon. So on behalf of the American Diabetes Association, I ask for your support.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Manning. I am the CEO of the Family YMCA of Marion and Polk Counties. I also work at a national level with our YMCA of the USA on scaling a YMCA diabetes prevention program nationwide. I also represent members of other YMCAs throughout the state of Oregon who are working towards putting together a diabetes prevention coalition as well, so we can offer services on a statewide level. There are others in the room and others sitting with me today that could probably speak more directly about the medical impacts and the costs of diabetes. I'd like to just touch base very briefly on some personal stories that I could share with you. I could tell you about my grandmother that passed away from diabetes-related complications. I could tell you about my mother and my father, who thankfully are still living but are both struggling with diabetes. I could tell you about my wife, Allie, who is pre-gestational, was diabetic, and is now pre-diabetic. More importantly, what I'd like to talk to you about, because I've spent a career within the YMCA of 20 years working on the prevention side of various chronic disease problems without even knowing I was working on the prevention side of it. Now the YMCA is officially within that arena. What I would like to just share with you and encourage you to support SB 169 is, from a personalized standpoint, you just heard the numbers mentioned from a children's perspective. I have four children. It might be my oldest son, Cameron, who is 17. It could be my son, Jack, who is 8, or it could be my daughter, Julia, who is 7, or it could also be my 2-year-old daughter, Jenna. Likely, one of the four of my children will have diabetes, just like those other children in the state of Oregon. So it's not just a medical problem. It's not just a cost problem. It's a very personal problem that tears at each family and really the heart of our society. So the YMCA wants to support this as well and work with others on a statewide level to minimize that tragic impact that it has on families and citizens across our state.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Go to panel 2. All right. Tom Boyer.
And that's it. Stuart Perry.
And Stuart Perry, yeah.
And Madam Chair, do you mind if I stay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Again, I'll be brief with my comments this time. Fortunately, for everybody here in this room, you've had the opportunity to hear what I've had to say over the last couple of years, and I can't thank you enough for your support and your continued effort to try to improve the health of people with diabetes here in Oregon, and to begin to contain the serious health costs and challenges that you're dealing with right now. I really have three relatively...
Please state your name.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Tom Boyer, Director of Government Affairs, Novo Nordisk. I apologize. Three relatively simple messages for you. The first is I encourage the committee to move forward with a work session in the near future related to this bill. I greatly appreciate your consideration of that request. The second is that in the 3 years that we've been discussing diabetes, I've described the reach of the epidemic in a few different ways to members of this committee, and I'm going to try it a little differently this time. If diabetes were a country, on the planet. It would be the third largest country, outranking the United States. Only China and India have a population that's larger than the population of people with diabetes living on this planet today. This is a massive healthcare financing problem. This is a massive personal health problem. It is testing every aspect of the health system, and we are seeing an increase of the disease 7 to 10% per year. And the costs are astronomical. Regardless of the measure that I use, regardless of who I point to for data, whether it's NCQA that says hospitalizations associated with diabetes doubled in the last decade, or I go to the CDC that shows that we're looking at situations where in some states where we've seen a greater than 100% increase in a 10-year period. It doesn't matter what the data source is. The question is, do we have the commitment to actually do something about this? And we're seeing nationally a lot of groups coming forward. National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, they're supportive of this legislation and are ready to provide technical assistance to the state to complete the report that's envisioned here. They have the expertise, they have the know-how, and they were recently credited by the state of Kentucky, where Stuart Perry is from, and he'll tell you a little bit about the Kentucky report that was recently published. They're credited with helping all the departments and programs there in Kentucky with putting the report together. They did great work, phenomenal work, and the report's a very telling document and a great example of what the state could follow. So National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, Council of State Governments, they support this bill as suggested state legislation. It's in their docket of suggested state bills for this year. Women in Government. Women in Government is so concerned about the diabetes problem that they're running a national campaign to convince legislators of the need to actually enact this bill in every state across the country. States from North Dakota to Hawaii to Oregon to Michigan, they're encouraging legislators to take action on this very problem. The unfortunate reality associated with diabetes is there are no reasonable solutions that are coming from the federal government. Everything needs to be a homegrown solution. That's the problem. So with that, I greatly appreciate your time. I am available for any questions, and thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much for coming.
Good afternoon, madam. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee. My name is Stuart Perry. I am a diabetes consultant. I'm a volunteer. I have had diabetes since 1990. I'm a former national chair of the board of the American Diabetes Association. I am here primarily to bat cleanup and get us off the docket so that you can move on, and to talk to you about Kentucky. But first, let me talk to you about Oregon. You've heard a lot of statistics, and you hear those, and you get testimony to those. And just I'd like to bring a little clarification to a few of them. The CDC published a report on November 16th of 2012. It was a report card on diabetes. From 1995 to 2010, in the state of Oregon, diabetes went up 65%. 65%. That's a lot. I will tell you that I bring you greetings from the Commonwealth of Kentucky. We went up 158%. We're number 7 in diabetes. We also own Kentucky Fried Chicken, bourbon, horses. Not that I would draw any delineation between those things and diabetes, but we decided in Kentucky that something had to happen, that it could not continue. We also found out there were silos in our state government. I know that comes as a shock to you to know that there are silos in state government that don't talk to each other, but that's what we experienced in Kentucky. In Kentucky, we said that enough is enough. So we passed the Diabetes Action Plan. The Diabetes Action Plan was passed 2 years ago, and the report is now hot off the presses. It just came out. Three governmental agencies got together. The only money that they spent was the money in having lunches and the meetings and the paper that they used. We didn't hire consultants. We didn't do anything outside. We used all internal data that we already had. And we produced a report. Is the report perfect? No, ma'am. Is the report something that is a start in trying to address this problem? It is. And that's what we're encouraging people around the country to do, is to start this process. You know, people say you have to learn to crawl before you can walk. And I'm a great believer in that. But in all honesty, what you have to do is recognize the problem. You heard Andrea talk about 8.6% in Oregon of diabetes. Well, you know, in 2005, that was 6.5%. So what is the cost in waiting? Another 2%, another 2.1%. And this is percentages, but we're talking about people's lives and families' lives and the devastations. I know that there's many medical professionals in front of me, and you know that devastation. I don't have to teach it to you. You see it every day. So in closing, just let me say that I am here. I do have the report. Tom has the report. Nikki has the report that we can show anyone in the government or send it to you electronically. That report doesn't address everything, but it's a good start. But what most importantly it does is it gives us the data. In 2009, there was a strategic plan done for Oregon. Yeah, I'm sure you're all familiar with it. You've seen it. Okay? On the front of this plan, it showed right here, if we act now, what happens to diabetes? Well, unfortunately, that's not gone down like that. It's gone up. So we've got to have something to address it. And I think this Diabetes Action Plan is the opportunity for the state of Oregon to get that done. I've enjoyed coming to your state. It's a beautiful state. It's my fourth trip, and it will not be my last one. I enjoy it a lot. Okay. And I applaud you for everything I've seen since I've been here. Just a sidebar. It's a gorgeous state, and I enjoyed coming, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Perry, for making the trip. You have a pretty nice-looking state there, too, having traveled through there this past spring. So I want to make it clear that I support this in general very, very strongly, and I'm really glad to see this back here. I am not one of the people who's heard about this because it's my first year on this committee, so it's good to hear some of the background on this. You know, in general, I think that if we think about the things that are driving health care costs in the state and nationally, they're the same things that drive the increase in diabetes. And really what you're asking for, if I understand correctly, we're calling this a diabetes action plan, but in reality it's addressing the determinants of diabetes, if you will. Inactivity, obesity, potentially immune challenges that are increasing autoimmune disorders for the type 1 diabetics. So we do think we need to be clear about the fact that this is going to require a coordinated effort. And this is not just about identifying and treating people who have diabetes, but I would hope, and it seems pretty clear from the language of the bill, one that would be looking at ways to reduce the actual incidence of diabetes and therefore the complications. It's much better to prevent a disease than to try to cure it. I have a couple of small concerns, and I just want to make sure that I understand this. I'm a little concerned about including the health insurance exchange, Cover Oregon, in this right now. I don't think it's really exactly what's in their charge, and I understand that there would be people would be willing to, I mean, I understand the point of including them. Frankly, I'm the insurance companies that will be participating in Cover Oregon should be very interested in engaging in this, and I would hope that they would be. I don't know if there are any of you all left in the room from the discussion of Senate Bill 122, but I would hope that we would be talking with them and saying, it may not be Cover Oregon dealing with this, but the companies participating should care about this because it's going to drive their costs substantially higher.
We do have Cover Oregon and OHA still yet
okay,
to testify.
Good. Well, then I'll let them talk about this directly. But I do think that it's something that participating insurance companies should be very interested in. I'm a little concerned about the timeline, frankly. January 1st of 2015 is a long time from now. If this has already been done in Kentucky and some other states, I'm not sure why we think it's going to take us that long to do that. I would venture to guess that pretty much any insurance company in this state, including OHP, could tell you right now, roughly speaking, even on a very superficial level, what diabetes is costing them. And we already have the statistics presented by the Diabetes Association about how many Oregonians are potentially at risk of being affected, are currently being affected or at risk of being affected. So I'm not trying to rush us into anything, but I'm curious as to why you pushed for 2015 rather than 2014 on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Steiner-Hayward, I believe that was just kind of a standard drafting timeline. I think there are just certain ways that LCs do. We'd be more than happy, I believe, to push that timeline forward. I think the sooner we get the answer, the better. We know that if you flipped a switch today, it would still be 20 years before you saw a decrease in the uptick of diagnoses of diabetes. So the sooner we can act, the better. And if I may follow up also to the point, Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, to the conversation with Cover Oregon, I think you have a valid point. And we've definitely been doing our due diligence and homework and talking with them. And so there are no surprises up here. I think we're all on the same page.
Great. Thank you very much. And perhaps the Health Authority, when you all come up, can talk a little bit about whether you think it's feasible to move the timeline up a little bit. And if any of the Providence folks who do a lot of the PEB stuff are still in the room, I don't know. But we need to think about that a little bit, about the timeline, because I'm concerned about paralysis through analysis. This is an urgent problem. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking again, I know. All right. With that, I'd like to call Dr. Katrina Hedberg from OHA and Amy Fave from Cover Oregon. Is there, before we start, is there someone here from PEB? I thought I talked to somebody. Yes, might as well just come up too. Please begin. Thank you.
Thanks. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Authority. And I have to start off by apologizing. I've had a cold. It's a week old, so I'm hoping that I won't pass it on to others. And I'm here to testify on the importance of addressing the issue of diabetes in Oregon. And I do have written testimony that I'll hand out. And I think what's important, you've already heard a lot of statistics, and we have a lot of data. In fact, I have a number of reports here in front of me that talk about the issue of having data related to diabetes. It's clear that it's a major public health issue, and it's one that has continued to increase. Again, I won't reiterate all the numbers that have gone back and forth. A lot of those data actually come from data we have. We collect data on death certificates, hospital discharge data. We can make estimates of exactly how much of direct and indirect medical care costs. We did have, as was already mentioned by the previous panel, a strategic plan to address and reverse trends in obesity and diabetes. Unfortunately, part of the reason that we haven't seen a downward tick like we would have hoped was because, unfortunately, we never had the resources to fully implement this plan. We really support, again, as has been previously mentioned, coordinated, well-planned, evidence-based efforts to reduce the burden of diabetes. And I think that that's the overall charge we would completely agree with. But in order to do that, this particular bill, SB 169, has very specific items around data collection and reporting, in addition to the efforts that we already have for tracking. And that would necessitate development of new data systems that we don't currently have, and would require us, again, to develop systems to report on the diabetes and the costs. We need to have to hire a medical economist or someone who could actually come up with some of these data. So currently we have estimates, but a lot of the things that are addressed in the bill are very specific, and in order for us to implement the bill as written, it would carry a fiscal impact. In addition, I really do think that the coordinated effort is important. As you know, the Health Authority, we now have the triple aim to promote better health, improve care, and lower costs as well. And again, you're fully aware that they were in the midst of transforming our health system, both here in Oregon through coordinated care organizations, as well as national efforts at healthcare reform. And part of that is to track not just the silo of each specific disease, but to think about patients, both the upstream extreme risk factors that we have, but to think about the efforts that we all need. While diabetes causes direct hospitalizations, and we certainly know that, whether people have complications that we know are directly related to elevated blood sugars, it also is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and a number of other things that in and of themselves need to be treated. So it's not as simple as we need to deal with diabetes in a silo, but rather as part of a coordinated care plan. So I think with that, again, I'd like to close. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that we really support efforts to both make people aware of the problems with diabetes and the fact that it has not yet leveled off as we would hope, but that at this point it is going to require resources in order to implement a plan, particularly as has been written previously in Oregon as well as other states. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to be to testify before you.
Thank you, Dr. Hedberg. With the development, well, first of all, I have a question. What part of our Medicaid population has diabetes? Do we have that stats?
I
had heard that it's higher.
Yes, so
than the normal.
Okay. I'm sorry, I don't have that directly in front of me, but
okay,
I think
that's
you're correct.
All right.
Yes, it is higher.
You know, with the creation of coordinated care organizations, our whole focus is going to be on prevention. And to me, it's extremely important, since diabetes is such a huge issue in this state, that coordinated care organizations are going to need some direction on maybe addressing the diabetes issue. And so what is the health the state doing about diabetes education to our coordinated care organizations?
Yes, so Chair Mona Sanderson, thanks for the question. So again, on a number of fronts, I think what has been talked about already is the need to both do the primary prevention to keep people from developing diabetes in the first place. But then, of course, there's secondary prevention. We want to make sure that people who have diabetes have it under control and have various preventive services, whether they be checking their blood sugars, hemoglobin A1C, foot check, eye exam, etc. Those need to be care that's delivered within a health coordinated care organization, patient-centered primary care home. There's also patient self-management programs that we'd like to have people more involved with as well. But as part of this, the coordinated care organizations, there are a series of metrics and things that they are going to be accountable to looking at. So we are working, again, within the larger OHA to make sure that some of these preventive services are those that CCOs will be covering as part of that. So again, that's the both doing the primary prevention as well as within the healthcare system.
Well, Senator Cruz has requested that we do a metrics analysis of what we're requiring of our coordinated care organizations regarding outcomes. And it just seems to me that that this bill, it would be nice to look at this bill and see what direction we are already taking, and I would like an analysis of what you feel we're already doing in this, what is going to be a part of the educational process with our coordinated care organizations, because the legislature, I feel, needs to make a statement on diabetes, and since it's a huge cause, and since we're right in the midst of health care reform, I really would like the agency to take a little bit more look at this bill and how we can make this bill Oregon's bill. So would it be possible? I know you have 100 other things that you're working on, with, especially with our health care reform that we're going through, but diabetes is a part of this. And I certainly would like to have a little bit more information from you.
Yeah. So, Chair Mona Sanderson, yes, we'd be happy to do that kind of analysis. So, again, I think, you know, we completely agree with the previous panel about the problem with diabetes and that it is potentially escalating. Again, we haven't seen the leveling off, and we do need to figure out how to address the issue. So, looking at what very specific things, because, again, I think we already have a lot of the data. We don't have exactly as is outlined in the bill, but we have a plan as well, yeah. Again, though.
Well,
not
I don't want a fiscal. I wanted to send this out with a do pass recommendation, and I would like it not to die in Ways and Means. And so I really would like to see what you can do to make this bill a doable bill.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Favre. I'm the Chief Communications Officer for Cover Oregon. And Cover Oregon is working very hard right now. We're laser focused on launching our first open enrollment period, which will begin on October 1st of this year, and focused on our mission of improving the health of Oregonians by providing health coverage options and increasing access to information. We're very concerned about the health of our future enrollees, the folks who will purchase plans, commercial insurance plans through the exchange, and on the quality of care that they receive. I like to describe Cover Oregon, the web portal that we'll be launching in October, as a combination between a Travelocity and a Consumer Reports. It'll be a place where people can go, shop for coverage, and have quality indicators. We worked with the Quality Corporation to develop a series of measures to be used in assigning quality grades to the plans that will be sold through the exchange, through the Cover Oregon. And one of those deals with diabetes screening. These grades will be used with aggregate data during the first year based on the carrier's experience, because the plans themselves don't actually exist yet. After the first year, the plans themselves will receive individualized grades. That being said, we don't currently collect any individual level or claims level data, or don't plan to collect any claims level data on the people who will be purchasing coverage through the exchange, which is one of the requirements of Senate Bill 169. So without going through the bill again, I'll just mention that there are several challenges for Cover Oregon in Senate Bill 169. Because we don't aren't currently planning to track the health status of customers who've who purchase their insurance through Cover Oregon, we don't actually run any programs that could be assessed in terms of their effectiveness and diabetes prevention. The information that we ask for and that we require from the enrollees must be related to their eligibility for Medicaid or for the health insurance tax credits. We have no legal way to compel enrollees to answer any questions about their health status. Our only avenue, our only option for collecting this data would be to do it through the insurance carriers that will be selling plans through Cover Oregon. And we're not currently set up, as I mentioned, to collect that sort of claims level data from the insurance carriers. We had an RFP last fall that has closed now for the qualified health plans that will be participating through the exchange. And we're currently in the process, along with the insurance division, of certifying those qualified health plans. The next opportunity to add additional requirements would be in our next RFP process, which will be in the fall of 2015 for the 2016 plan year. But even if we were to attempt to collect that data, our federal grant funds that fund all of our development work to date and operational costs through 2014, when we requested those funds, we did not include the cost of the funding that would be needed to carry out the collection, validation, analysis, and the reporting that would be required under Senate Bill 169. Long term, once we're no longer receiving federal funds, Cover Oregon will be funded through an administrative fee based on plans sold through the exchange that's currently capped in state law at maximum of 3 to 5%. So obviously this the expense of collecting this data would have to get factored into that fee that would get passed through. As has been mentioned today, we've had conversations with the proponents of this bill about having Cover Oregon removed from this requirement, and we'll continue those conversations. We will be continuing to ask that we be removed.
Thank you. And I would agree with you, and if it's all right with the proponents, Sandy, it would be nice to draft an amendment to remove them from this bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Questions?
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Denise Hall. I'm the Deputy Administrator, actually, for the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, but I'm here to testify on the experience of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board and the Public Employees Benefit Board in relation to diabetes in their populations. Both boards have actually been giving a lot of attention to diabetes under our programs. They both participate in the biennial survey that is handled by the Public Health, the Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. Easier to say, yeah. But looking at the diabetes levels in 2009 and compared to 2011, the OEB members actually went down very slightly from 5.1% down to 5%. On the other hand, the Public Employee Benefit Board population actually decreased the prevalence from 7.2% down to 5.1% in that two-year period. The boards believe that some of the programs they have in the health plans have been able to do that. We have full coverage for evidence-based tobacco cessation, full coverage for weight management programs that are available to employees, covered spouses and domestic partners, and kids that are 10 and up on all of our programs. We have low or no cost coverage of treatment for diabetes on all of our plans, including services and supplies. We also have a chronic care benefit that allows office visits at a low or no copayment for those with diabetes. We also promote community-based diabetes prevention and self-management programs. In fact, the one that they spoke about with the YMCA, we are looking at ways to be able to support that program under our plans. And we have full coverage for relevant recommendations from the U.S. Healthcare Task Force in relation to diabetes. So we believe that those items in our plans have helped PEB and OEB make a difference in the diabetes in those programs. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
It sure would be nice if you could look at this bill and look at the data sets that they are asking for and see what PEB and OEB are already doing and what is just not realistic. I want to get a feel for what you can do or what you can't do on what this bill is asking. Would that be possible?
Madam Chair, yes, it would be. We can
Thank
work
you very
with
much.
Them.
Questions? All right, we have some work. I think, Nikki, you can work with Sandy, and once we get, you know, some input basically from PEB, OEB, and from the Oregon Health Authority, we'll make this bill a better bill. All right? All right. Thank you. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 169 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 167. Madam Administrator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill, whoops, sorry. That's 109. I apologize. Okay. 167 grants authority to the public health director that during a disease outbreak, grant authority to pharmacists to administer vaccines to persons 10 years of age or younger. There's a dash one amendment, either online or in your packet, that was requested by the health department, public health division, and I believe all parties involved are okay with that amendment.
Great. And all right. Bill Cross and Amy Valdez.
Committee Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And this bill came out of a discussion that we had with some of the folks at OHA last summer, fall, just talking about this topic in general. And we felt it was important to provide the legislature an opportunity to look at this policy to help assist in influenzas and health epidemics of the vaccination of children. And so I'll introduce Amy Valdez, who will talk a little bit about the benefits of the legislation.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee,
Thank you. For the record, my name is Amy Valdez. I am a registered pharmacist here in the state of Oregon, practicing pharmacy in our great state, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 167. Currently in the state of Oregon, pharmacists are given authority by statute to prescribe and administer vaccinations to patients ages 11 and older. We do have opportunity to vaccinate other patients, but we have to do that under the Drug Administration rule, which requires us to have both a appropriate legal prescription and a protocol. The protocol in that case is not really an issue. The most commonly used protocols are the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice protocols issued by the CDC, which are very commonly used. But the prescription in that case becomes problematic because it does have to be either a written prescription that is given to the patient, or it has to be transmitted to the pharmacist from the prescriber, either electronically by facsimile or by telephone. Pharmacists in Oregon and across the United States do receive rigorous training in immunization administration as well as vaccine preventable diseases. And the most commonly...
Just a question, where do you get that training?
The training, the Board of Pharmacy in Oregon doesn't require a specific training, but there are multiple training programs used. One example is the American Pharmacist Association certificate program for pharmacy-based immunization delivery. There are other similar programs across the United States. And so...
With children under 10... do you think that the pharmacist would be giving them to babies 6 months? I forget when the first set of...
Yeah. Right. So the common pharmacist-based training programs cover down to approximately age 3. They cover deltoid administration. So it's patient-specific, but typically at age 3 is when you would consider making that change from a thigh to a deltoid administration.
So it is just deltoid then?
Correct.
And the weight of the child, et cetera, do you take into account that also? Is there guidelines for that?
Absolutely. So in the training program, pharmacists learn to assess the site of the administration. And if it's not of an appropriate size to vaccinate, then the pharmacist would not vaccinate in that case. And we are not trained to vaccinate outside of the deltoid area, so we would refer them to another provider in that case.
Thank you.
So,
Senator Hayward?
Yeah, thank you. So then, just to finish this, and then I'll have another question later, but...
Sure.
Why is the language of the bill such that it's under 10? I mean, I'm a family physician, so I do lots of immunizations, or more accurately, I give orders to my staff to do lots of immunizations. And I don't think there's any question that you would give an immunization to a one-year-old and they're deltoid. It's just not big enough. It doesn't have the muscle mass. You wouldn't do it. It'd be bad practice, and it would be dangerous. So why did we make this under 10 instead of from ages, you know, down to, you know, or above, I don't know, why did we not put a lower end on this range?
A three or four.
3 year old or when
size.
We do begin to, for size range or.
More of a size range.
Well, actually, it wouldn't, because size doesn't necessarily relate to muscle mass, and what you're really thinking about in this case is muscle mass as opposed to weight. And
well,
so
you
can
do
if you
a body index. And
no, because body index doesn't actually reflect muscle mass. I'm sorry, that's being
that's all right.
Technical here.
Don't argue with the physician.
Not being the author of the bill, I don't know why there was not a bottom age put on it. I know why 10 and under was chosen was simply that because that right now we're restricted at age 11.
Right, and I understand that part of it. And in general, I want to be clear, I'm supportive of this. I have a lot of questions, but I'm a little puzzled given what you're telling me, that they're only trained for deltoid, which I understand and I think is a good plan, why we wouldn't. Why would we would be comfortable authorizing all the way down to birth when we know that they're not getting the appropriate training?
Madam Chair, I'd point out that there will be an advisory committee set up to promulgate rules, and I suppose that sort of detail.
And Lorraine Duncan is here also, there. But let's finish the testimony okay. here, and then we can get in the nitty-gritty. Yeah.
Sure. So there is a gap currently between the level where pharmacists are trained to administer and what we're currently legally authorized to do without a prescription. And when this becomes really important is during outbreaks of disease. So many people don't realize that there are outbreaks of disease consistently in the United States for things like measles, mumps, influenza, pertussis, meningococcal, recently in our own state, where it's important to vaccinate large populations of people of all ages quickly. And so that's where it becomes important to have an increased number of providers. And this bill would support increasing the number of providers available for younger children under the age of 11. I have seen this personally in the last year in a couple of instances. One was the pertussis epidemic to our north in the state of Washington, and most recently with the flu epidemic on the West Coast, where people were flooding into pharmacies seeking vaccinations that they had procrastinated on. And so increasing the number of providers and access to care for those patients becomes very important. I think another thing that it could do besides making better access to care is alleviate some of the strain on other healthcare providers during an outbreak of disease, allowing them to concentrate on treating people who have actually contracted the disease and letting pharmacists focus on the preventative aspect as well. Thank you.
Great. Yes, Senator Cruz and then Senator Steiner-Hewitt.
My question is, I mean, this allows the public health director to make the determination. All other emergency situations, it's the governor who makes a declaration, or there's a separation here. I'm just wondering.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there is a dash one set of amendments that addresses that very issue that would allow the governor the same authority that we're giving the public health director as well.
I mean, the public health director would administer, obviously, but disasters and emergencies are in the purview of the governor to make the declaration, I would think. You know, in consultation, if the public health director says we got a problem, then John could just say bang and he goes. But I want the line of.
I'll record that.
Okay. I'm sorry. Dr. Steiner-Hayward?
I think this is a great idea, and I'm really supportive of it. And I would just make it clear that it's the reason I'm really in support of it is because of the access issues and because we have such a great immunization alert system in this state, and the pharmacists include their immunizations in ImmuAlert, which means that I don't worry about the continuity of care issues, and I don't worry about double immunization because I know that the immunizations that you all are providing. The other question I was going to ask has gone straight out.
Well, why don't we
sorry.
Ask Lorraine Duncan just to come up? And I've worked with Lorraine for many, many years. I've given many, 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 many immunizations. And so it would be nice to just, I'm more interested in the training. You know, I don't have a problem with this at all down to, say, 3 years of age. But I'm getting a little nervous about those who don't. As Dr. Steiner, how you would say, have the muscle mass and the deltoid, et cetera. So could you just address the training issues
that they have? Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the immunization program manager for the Oregon Health Authority. The health authority is neutral on this bill, but be happy to answer any questions that you have. And
Training in the deltoid of do we have any evidence of the type of training that would be needed to give an immunization to someone 3 years of age upward?
So we have training programs available, even an educational module that we've just developed that we'd be happy to share with the Pharmacy Association. I think we have several nurses that are adequately trained and would be happy to provide that training. So I think, you know, in the case of needing training for a younger group, we could certainly provide it.
And I'm in a dilemma here whether that's necessary or not, but give me some input on that.
Sure. I'm actually a faculty instructor for the American Pharmacist Association pharmacy-based immunization certificate program, so I can speak to that content. And there is complete administration coverage down to age 3. So we cover how to assess the site, how to properly choose needle length, and how to properly dose vaccines down to that age in the deltoid.
But
so the program is very thorough.
The angle of the and the depth and do we still have some that are subcutaneous versus,
We do. We cover intramuscular and subcutaneous injection down to age 3. And they also cover angle, depth, which would be, you know, needle length as well. It is a combination of video-based training as well as live content with the instructor. So they do watch a video of immunizations given, both intramuscular and subcutaneous, and then followed by a practice session. And so pharmacists can't become certified without the practice session and an instructor signing off on their technique.
Great.
Can I just follow up on that? Mm-hmm. So, for example, this year we had the new intradermal influenza vaccine. And would you guys get updates on that, or do you feel like that's already covered in your training? Because that's a great way to do the – I mean, speaking to someone who got that one this year, it hurt a lot less than afterwards, at least. It hurt when I was getting it, but not as much afterwards than the intramuscular one. So do you guys get updates? Do you have a continuing education requirement around that at all if you're going to be doing it? How does that work?
Thank you, Senator. That's a great question. We do get updates. So with this particular program and all of them, there is a committee, a national committee of faculty who update the content regularly. And so in the instance of new products, when that product was released, a training update and video were released. New slides go out to all the faculty trainers like myself, and then we immediately implement that in our upcoming classes as well as train all of our current immunizers that there is a new product available, new technique. In our case, we provided all of our pharmacists at my company with training devices and instructions to practice with those devices before they actually use them on patients so that they're comfortable with the technique of a new product. So, yes, that is included in the national training.
I remember I used the gun. I always call it the gun. I shouldn't say that, especially in this environment that we're in right now. Do those, or you stick with needles?
Strictly needles right now. As far as I know, there aren't any products that are currently approved to be used with the needleless device. Are you talking about the needleless device?
Years ago, we had a jet injector.
Oh, okay.
Jet injector. That's what I used.
We don't use those anymore.
Already, it's out.
They're gone. Yeah.
So we still have a couple if you want to look at them.
Currently, it would cover administration by injection and also nasal administration. So we would have pharmacists administering nasal vaccine as well.
Okay. I'd like to call Gary Schnabel up also from he's the executive director of the Board of Pharmacy.
The best way to get an immunization like a flu shot is just have it and stick it in your IV after surgery. Works really well.
I don't want surgery. Sorry.
They did it for me.
No, they didn't.
Yes, they did.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Dillon really wants to talk to me. Are you okay if I...
Yes, I would. Yes. Okay. I mean, you can go ahead because we want some amendments. I need to get some information about the age, whether we should maybe look at an age. And I don't know what age is where we can really, where the body mass is in the deltoid is, I just don't know an age because I know of some pretty skinny 3-year-olds. So, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gary Schnabel, Executive Director for the Board of Pharmacy. I didn't plan on testifying today, but with that last question, I thought I could add a perspective at least. The Board of Pharmacy doesn't have a position on the bill. They have not reviewed it to take a position, but they don't have any problem with that. Understanding that the training goes down to about a three-year-old level, we would expect that a pharmacist would not try to immunize somebody under three.
Yeah.
Because they aren't trained to do that. And the board would consider that unprofessional conduct. They can't do something they're not trained to do, even if the law doesn't say you can't do it. If you're not trained, you better not do that, or you're going to be in trouble with the board. So if that makes any difference.
That's great. All right. I would feel comfortable if we designate that, but so if we could draft an amendment, but I still want to talk with the proponents of the bill and as well as the health authority regarding this issue. And now if there's a complaint regarding someone not giving the right medication or right immunization, et cetera, what's the process of a complaint then?
Normally we have investigators. We would take the complaint. They do a full investigation and make a report to the board members, and then the board members deliberate and vote whether to take disciplinary action.
So there is a process in place if that should ever occur.
Yes, and then if anyone has a problem with a vaccine, we are required to report to VAERS as well as pharmacists.
Cool. All right. Well, I know that at least I and I heard Dr. Steiner here are very much in favor of this bill, but I think just a few amendments might make it a better bill. Okay.
All right. I agree.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167, and we are adjourned. Oh, yeah, no, wait.
Don't turn it off yet.
I want to let you know that on February 18th, we are having a film called American Winter, and it's an hour and a half. And so many of you may not be able to stay for the whole thing. I certainly am, and we have invited the House. Representative Tomei. It's filmed in Oregon. It is a film, and it's going nationwide, dealing with homelessness and poverty, and people have lost their jobs and homes and the resources. So I'm inviting everyone to stay after our committee meeting on next Monday, and I'll announce it again.
Could we have a double feature and maybe show The Hobbit afterwards? I think that would be...
Hey, you never know. Okay. With that, we're definitely officially adjourned.